Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, crazy martinis for you as usual. We start with the good, and Jim, this one just broke a little while before we started recording here late Friday morning, and that's that our beloved Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, has announced that she is leaving that position effective September, leaving to become the head of the University of California system. Apparently, it's about triple the salary. We probably don't have the highest of expectations on who exactly will replace her at Homeland Security, right in the midst of this immigration debate, no less. But the fact that the system is working is not going to be around anymore. She, of course, made that comment after the guy nearly lit his underpants on fire and took down an airliner on Christmas Day 2009. The fact that she's going to be gone, I don't think too many conservatives are going to be crying about that.
Just handed to me, Greg, Lois Lerner of the IRS is the likely candidate. You know, this is the good martini because it's not like many of us are really going to miss Janet Napolitano. And let's begin by saying, look, it's a tough job. Nobody hears about your successes. Nobody wants to hear from you, et cetera. But as everyone's talking about what a fantastic record she has, look, this is, you know, you mentioned the system worked, came after the underwear bomber. We had the memo describing right-wingers as terrorists, the people they should be on the lookout for, Fort Hood, TSA groping, and of course, perhaps most notably, the Boston Marathon bombing. That's not a sterling record. You know, there's some big hitches and bumps in the road, and you know, there's kind of been this kind of casual acceptance. It ascribes some of it to liberal media bias of, oh, well, she's Obama's gal, so they're going to cut her some slack. Some of it might be we just don't expect, you know, we're like, we just kind of now expect TSA to grope people as they go through the airline security and stuff like that. We expect a certain number of things like the Boston Marathon bombers to kind of slip through the radar. We keep lowering our standards for government, and it seems to keep finding new ways to dive beneath even those low standards. Not enormous optimism about the person who will replace Napolitano. The confirmation hearings may be interesting to kind of, you know, look at the decision-making we've seen at DHS. A new DHS secretary right in the middle of a immigration debate could be kind of interesting in the coming weeks and months. So we'll see. Janet Napolitano, not a fantastic record, despite what you're probably going to hear in the coming days. Maybe from this we can get some, you know, serious debate about whether DHS really needs to operate the way it does or whether there are parts we can cut back or eliminate and whether we need people sniffing our sneakers anymore.
On to martini number two now, Jim, and I'm sure you remember back in the Bush administration, and this happens pretty much in any situation where the White House is controlled by one party and the other party has the ability to stop nominations in the Senate. It was judicial nominations, particularly in the Bush years, and they were going to change the filibuster rules that simple majorities was all you would need to approve judicial nominees. Well, Democrats just went crazy about that idea, saying it was going to dismantle the way the Senate is structured, the whole power balance in the United States government and so forth. So ultimately, we got another gang. I think it was 14 at that time. Came up with some deal. Certain nominees who had been held up by the Democrats were going to get a vote, and the rules were never changed. Well, now Harry Reid is upset with a number of nominees that are being held up by Republicans in the Senate, including the president's nominee to head the Department of Labor, Thomas Perez. There's also, of course, these appointments to the National Labor Relations Board that are currently in the midst of a federal court fight right now because the president nominated them as recess appointments when the Senate was not in recess. And so the Republicans are obviously reluctant to approve people who shouldn't be there. But now Harry Reid is doing exactly what Bill Frist was doing almost a decade ago. And that's planning to change the rules so Republicans can't filibuster these nominees. So what goes around comes around, I guess, Jim.
The arguments we've seen on the filibuster going back to the Bush years are pretty transparently, you could argue, hypocritical or just say situational. When you're in the majority, you want to eliminate the filibuster. It's not fair. We've got 50-some votes, so we should get what we want. 60 votes is this unreasonable standard, blah, blah, blah. And then when you're in the minority, whoa, 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 the filibuster is this important tradition that, you know, is absolutely necessary to preserve the rights of the minority, blah, 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 blah. To me, my attitude towards, you know, a lot of sides is just pick a standard and stick to it. Filibusters can't be important only when you're in the minority, and they can't be this terrible tool of obstruction for the other side. Now, I would argue, looking back, you know, I'm one of those guys who remembers the name Miguel Estrada, a very qualified judge who never got through. And, you know, as a result of that, my attitude is, all right, if you're going to filibuster my guy, I'm going to filibuster the bejesus out of anything you want to get through there. Barack Obama, maybe the single greatest and most egregious offender of shifting his position when depending on whether he's in the majority or the minority. But having said that, if we need to pick one, I'd rather preserve the filibuster as is than to eliminate it. The point being that I think it was Calvin Coolidge who said, it's more important to prevent bad laws from being passed than from enacting good laws. I guess you could say I fear the damage of bad laws more than I feel this unbelievable need for a good law. And my other observation is that, you might argue that in an era of great partisanship and, when you have 55 and the other side, you've got minorities very unified, and even if they might have, some parts of the bill you're proposing, they don't want to give the president a win and all that stuff. Look, 60 votes isn't unbelievably difficult, okay? In most of the modern era, it has meant you got to keep your caucus together and get, five or six or four or some minor, a handful of the opposition. If your idea can't get a handful of the opposition, maybe it's not that good idea after all. I am one of those guys who remembers way back when on the debate of Hillary Care back in 1993, 1994, I believe it was Bill Bradley and Daniel Patrick Moynihan who were saying to Hillary and the folks at the White House, you want this to pass with at least 70 votes. You really want to get closer to 80. You want to get 20 or 30 Republicans to buy into this. And this means not getting everything you want and probably putting in some stuff that you don't want. But, you need a whole lot of votes to pass a really big sweeping change. Well, that was the old school of thinking. And it's interesting. Look back to the enactment of the Department of Homeland Security, to think back to our last martini. Look back to the Iraq war vote. You don't see, narrow party line votes on most of those big pieces of legislation, welfare reform and stuff like that. Usually you get a sizable majority that is, if not bipartisan, has a considerable chunk of the minority party voting for it. Well, that era is gone. We saw it on the stimulus bill. We saw it on the Obamacare vote. We saw it on, one piece of legislation after another. Each side kind of says the other side is being unreasonable. I don't think 60 votes is a crazy standard to have to say, hey, we've got a really good idea. And if you're in the majority, you really shouldn't want to pass things on a 55-45 vote or a 51-49 vote, because it means that the other side probably has some good reason to oppose that. Now, obviously, everybody always thinks that their side's reasons are good reasons, the other side's reasons are crazy, ideological, stubborn nonsense and stuff. So it's a very tiresome debate, because here's the thing. Republicans take back the majority in 2014. By spring of 2015, Harry Reid will be making the exact opposite arguments of what he's making right now.
Well, let's hope so. It doesn't take long to get tired of Harry Reid's hushed, mumbled outrage as he's making the argument on the floor. Jim, we've seen this year the reemergence of Anthony Weiner in New York. He's running for mayor. Just earlier this week, we talked about Elliot Spitzer. He's running for comptroller in New York City. Obviously, they have both had, let's just call them situations in the past that put their integrity into question. And now we have another situation out in the city of San Diego. Bob Filner, longtime congressman from California, recently elected mayor out there. He's now been accused by at least three women for sexual harassment, and he's essentially admitted to this, but in his statement, it's kind of Orwellian here. As someone who has spent a lifetime fighting for equality for all people, I'm embarrassed to admit that I have failed to fully respect the women who work for me and with me, and at times I've intimidated them. He also says he's going to get some help, and of course it'll be funded all by the city of San Diego. So I'm pretty sure he just started this year in this role, Jim. So, San Diego, you might want to think about this the next time he's on the ballot.
I'm going to quote Richard Grinnell, the Republican foreign policy analyst, who says, if Bill Clinton had a son, he'd look like Bob Filner. So Filner popped up on my radar screen back in 2010. Nick Popadich was this retired Marine who was running for Congress. Nick Popadich is one of my all-time favorite guys. Obviously a fantastic, amazing life story, fantastic attitude, just the kind of guy you want to get behind and help anyway again. He ran in 2010 against Filner and did not succeed. He ran in 2012 against a different Democrat because Filner was getting ready to run for mayor of San Diego, and he did not win then. But Filner always stuck in my craw. He always came across as just your generic California Democrat establishment creature. Nobody was giving warm, fuzzy descriptions of Bob Filner, but I had not described about something like this. We don't know the specifics of these sexual harassment allegations. We don't know if this is just inappropriate comments or whether there's groping or something much worse. Anyway, but apparently it's quite widespread. Apparently this is not a one or two isolated incidents, and his allies on the city council are calling for him to go. For that to happen, the stories about this have to be pretty darn bad, and it has to be a sort of thing which you now find, you know, to come out and make this very big generic confession. What I find particularly, you know, bizarre and appalling, and kind of, you know, I want to see people rise up over this. He makes this very strange, you know, wording in these sorts of things in which he says, you know, I failed to fully respect the women who work for me. Greg, is that what they're calling it now? I mean, like, it's such a mealy-mouthed, lawyer-ese, you know, description of it. And then, of course, his closing thing is, give me an opportunity to prove I am capable of change. No. One, I mean, I don't know how many companies, you know, have policies on this sort of thing where, well, you have clearly sexually harassed many of your employees, but we're going to give you an opportunity to prove you're capable of change. Does that work in the criminal justice system? Yes, I've done something terrible, but it's possible that in the future I won't do terrible things, so please let me have no consequence. And then this whole culture of therapy added. Did Filner not realize that the women were not appreciating whatever he was doing to them? That usually if it's not wanted, women are generally, you know, make those their views clear. And oh, by the way, if you're somebody's boss, you really ought to be extra kind of careful of that sort of thing, because you're in a position of authority and power over them. And, you know, you get the feeling if he's a Republican, he'd already be big national news and they'd be, you know, demanding his resignation and all that kind of stuff. So we'll see if there's any real consequences for Filner. I myself am already starting up the Nick Popovich for mayor bandwagon.
Not a bad idea. Yeah, it's very interesting that whenever Republicans get caught up in something like this, they're seemingly pushed out immediately, and in just about every case, rightly so, whereas rehab, as you mentioned, is almost always the solution for the Democrats. And of course, there's no need for them to leave office unless they absolutely have to. See Elliot Spitzer and Anthony Weiner, for example.
Yeah, so. And let me just kind of observe, like, this whole idea of therapy. Am I to believe that, like, there's some sort of, like, psychological condition in which you don't realize that sexually harassing employees is wrong? Well, it's not that I'm a jerk. It's that there's something wrong with my brain and I need therapy. It's just a kind of appalling sense of, like, it's not me. It's some sort of alien virus that's making me do this thing. Keep in mind, Greg, by the way, that alien virus is at this point, my working theory about the behavior of Bob McDonald. That may explain why he's taking gifts and stuff from donors every left and right. But just kind of, you know, appalling. So if he gets away with this therapy thing, then you know you're going to see every single politician caught in similar, you know, circumstances say, well, it wasn't me. It was this, you know, terrible kleptomaniac, you know, nymphomaniac condition I have that, you know, makes my impulse control terrible. And, you know, I'm a fan of consequences, and there will be some consequences for Filner here.
Yeah. My only regret after today's three martini lunch is that we weren't able to tie any of these stories to the moon park. We were hoping to do 3 days in a row on that. But
send Filner to the moon park.
Yeah. There you go. Jim, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And join us again on Monday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.